KTOO would like to acknowledge that we broadcast from the homelands of the Occoquan. The Dene Di have stewarded this area for thousands of years. The tidelands where our studios sit are now covered over with buildings, roads, and parking lots, but they were once an embarking point for fishing and hunting grounds and to gatherings in other villages, and a place where children played on the beaches and learned to row in the harbor. In sharing this history, KTOO hopes to honor the ancestors and the descendants of the Occoquan. We recognize those families who have never relinquished their ownership and stewardship of their land and waterways and continue to cherish and depend upon their immediate connection to the waterfront for today and for future generations. We'd also like to take a moment to say thank you to the individuals who helped us craft our daily land acknowledgement. Gunachish to Vera Starbird, who planted the idea of making it super place specific and guided us on pronunciation. Lillian Petershore, who created so much of the beautiful structure. Ishmael Hope, who gave additional ideas, and Ernestine Hayes, Bob Sam, and Fran Houston, who gave important feedback. We are grateful to all of those offering guidance as we grow as an organization. You're listening to Juno Afternoon. I'm Shelley Delaney. Subsistence, hunting, fishing, foraging, and harvesting are a traditional as well as a daily part of the life for many Alaskans, and for others, maybe not so much. So joining us now, Jennifer New, Community Foods Program Director for the Coalition of Food and Sustainability Catalyst for the Southeast Sustainable Partnership. Hi, Jennifer.
Hi.
That's quite a title.
It's a couple titles jumbled together. Thank you.
Yeah. And Megan Stanglin, Manager of the Salt and Soil Marketplace. Hello, Megan.
Hi.
Thanks so much to both of you for being here today. And I just want to mention that you and your respective organizations are also both part of the Southeast Alaska Watershed Coalition. And today you're here to talk about a 7-day Eat Local Food Challenge. So let's start with a little background. How did this idea come to be?
Yeah, so this the Local Foods Challenge was started as a way to really get us more connected to our food system. So it's not just where about what we eat, but it's about where it comes from, who's involved, and all the impacts it has along the way. And so the challenge is about, in general, is about increasing our knowledge, our skills, and then strengthening the networks that we have around supporting our local and regional food system.
Megan, would you add anything to that?
Yeah, so this food challenge is part of a larger summer-long program that is the Southeast Alaska Local Foods Challenge. And so this is kind of the culminating project at the end of the season where we can really foster a sense of celebration around local foods and everything that we've been doing all summer long in terms of hunting, gathering, and learning Skillshare information and sharing with others about the local food systems here in Southeast.
When it comes to this challenge, the actual eating of the food is actually kind of the last step. There's a lot of categories and levels of participation that lead up to consumption. And the way you've organized it all is very comprehensive. So I wondered if we could talk a little bit more about that, if you could kind of share the different levels and the different categories and what went into putting all that together.
Yeah, so we have 10 categories as part of the challenge. And so 4 of the categories are all about harvesting. So here in Southeast, we're really fortunate that we can gather a lot of wonderful wild foods. We can hunt, there's fishing, a lot of seafood. We can also grow different things to eat. And we can also buy local foods as well from the people who are producers. And then the other categories are centered around food preservation. So being able to safely put away foods for winter for long-term storage when these foods are not available. And then as far as distributing, we have the share category, which is traditionally a way that people can distribute foods to those who maybe aren't able to get them themselves. It's always wonderful to share with family members. And so sharing is a really big part of an equitable food system. And then finally, we've got the closing the gaps, I call it, which is composting, nutrient recovery, And so figuring out ways to recover the things that that can be used again. So feeding what feeds our food system. So composting food scraps, fish scraps, and then also reducing food waste.
Megan, what would you add to that, since you're sort of on the, I don't know if you would call it sharing, the sharing category, or how would you describe your role as a retailer of local foods?
Yeah, I have a great job. I get to be the market manager of the Southeast Alaska Local Food Hub, which, if you haven't heard about it, the Salt and Soil Marketplace is basically an online farmers market. So I get to connect with local food producers throughout the region. We have at least 11 different communities with producers currently participating on the marketplace, all throughout Southeast. And then I get to be that connection between local food and the consumer, or local food producers and the consumers. So I really have a really neat job in getting to communicate about local food opportunities, but also connect consumers with the amazing number of local food producers we have in the community. Sometimes I think it's easy for us to fall into this trap of feeling isolated from the rest of the world, in, or even the rest of the United States, in terms of access to food. But when we really look at the number of food producers and the number of food resources we have available locally, it's pretty staggering. So getting to connect consumer with producer is exciting.
So kind of stating the obvious here, but eating local, subsistence, hunting, fishing, foraging, you know, Native Alaskans have been doing that for thousands of years. It's nothing new. But these days, how easy or difficult is it to connect to sustain that way of life, to learn it, to get back to it? What are some of the barriers?
I think one of the biggest parts of this challenge, the challenge is really designed about having each individual participant take a look at how they currently interact with their food system, identify where they stand in terms of that process, and then attempt to level up. So if you are already somebody who is very knowledgeable about fishing within your community, it's our hope that you connect with other individuals who are also interested in fishing. Or if you're super knowledgeable about food preservation, or maybe about foraging for mushrooms or certain species of plants, it's our hope that people who are passionate and knowledgeable about certain areas of our food system share that information with others, because that sharing culture is so incredibly important in ensuring that a lot of this traditional knowledge and experiential learning is passed on to other people.
So it's September now, and by now a lot of people will have fish, berries, seafood, et cetera, stored away. What else does someone need to succeed with this challenge? I guess now I'm thinking in terms of like putting together a menu for your 7 days.
Yes, I'll jump in. And then if Jen wants to add as well, I think this is the most exciting part of the challenge, because it is challenging. But when you do recognize how many options we have for locally available food, it's pretty staggering. I mean, for one thing, you could probably take a look at your own fridge or freezer. And if you've been fishing at all this summer, I mean, that's a great start to any meal right there. If you're a hunter and you still have a freezer full of game meat, then that's awesome as well. But I think that this challenge is also an opportunity to be able to connect with local producers that maybe you haven't ventured to before. We have a lot of really amazing local food resources everywhere, from the marketplace, Salt and Soil, to folks like Panhandle Produce, who are doing something very similar in a brick and mortar scale. And to be able to take maybe recipes that you make on a weekly basis and determine how you could tweak that recipe to include more local food items. It's really important that we support our local producers. It's important for our own health and nutrition and sense of well-being. It's important economically for the producers in our communities. But there's also a very large amount of money that goes out of state to be able to purchase items from local food chains, which oftentimes we could find very even better alternatives here locally. So really challenging people to take a look at what they do eat on a daily basis and see what simple swaps they could make that will make a huge difference, not only for them personally, but also for our economics in our community.
Yeah. Jennifer, do you want to add it to anything that Megan just said?
Yeah. Thank you so much, Megan. The only thing that I would add would be that for anyone that is interested in doing this challenge and maybe is looking to add to what they already have, or maybe they don't have everything that they'd like, they can look for local producers and buy local, and they can also maybe trade. Trading is also a really fantastic way to exchange. And sometimes there's work exchanges. You could chop wood, or you could help someone put away their garden. There's always an endless amount of work involved with local foods, mending nets and things like that. So being able to help out a producer through labor and through spending time with them could be a great way to procure some local foods for the challenge.
Hmm. These are all such great suggestions. Thank you both. I wanted to ask, maybe from your personal, if you guys are cooks yourselves or, you know, make a lot of food at home, what would you put on your menu for the next 7 days? Maybe like a breakfast or lunch, a snack or dinner. Do you have any examples from your own personal pantries that you'd like to share?
Yeah, for me, definitely fish. I swear that I could live off of anything that comes out of the sea, probably. Anything from seaweed to fish. But I think salmon's a really easy one. You could eat it for every meal of the day, or at least I could. Everything from lox in the morning on a bagel, or even on some local eggs if you have a neighbor who has chickens, or if you can purchase eggs locally from the marketplace. And then also, if you cook up a big bunch of salmon at the beginning of the week, you can eat on it for a couple of days. I mean, I think that's the beauty of some of these items, is you can transform them in many different ways, which allows for versatility, and that way you don't get bored. So you could take a salmon fillet one night, and what doesn't get consumed could then be turned into salmon patties, or you can even take the shredded flaked fish and mix it into an omelet the next day. So really just trying to be creative. And then, of course, as Jennifer had already mentioned, ensuring that we waste as little food as possible. So if there is anything that can't be consumed, then making sure that we return that to either a compost, recycle situation, so that we are minimizing our waste impact as well.
Jennifer, how about you? What's one of your favorite local foods?
Yeah, I really love berries. I definitely would probably have lots of berries somewhere in the menu, whether for breakfast, lunch, and or dinner. I have a friend that is an amazing mushroom harvester, and she has gifted me quite a lot of mushrooms that I've pickled and put away. And so I'd probably be looking at some of the mushrooms that have been preserved. And then I guess the other thought is that potatoes are something that always do super well, no matter where you are. And so I'll probably be looking for potatoes on the marketplace, or seeing if anyone needs help digging up potatoes in their garden. So yeah. And then kale also does really well in Southeast. So if there's kale, I think that those are the main staples. There's always little things here and there.
Right. Little forest treats, little delicacies. Well, we touched on this a little bit, but of course not everyone who lives here has easy access to local foods or boats or fishing gear, processing tools, and maybe most importantly, the time it all takes. So what resources are available to make local foods affordable and easy to buy?
Yeah, so we have some great resources. As I already mentioned, I'm the market manager for the Southeast Alaska Food Hub, the Salt and Soil Marketplace. So if folks are interested in purchasing from local producers, a lot of local producers congregated in one location, the marketplace is a great opportunity for that. You just go to www.saltandsoilmarketplace.com. Other great options are reaching out directly to producers. The Panhandle Produce out by Costco. They also do a really great job. Everything that they hold within their store is all locally derived as well. The other thing you can do is reach out to your neighbor. Like Jennifer always said, there's a lot of labor involved. There's a lot of labor of love involved in local food. And so helping somebody maybe put their garden to bed for the winter and they're willing to trade you, that's a very economical way to gain local foods. And then I think we also have some great opportunities coming up. I believe there's one more open air market for the Jack. And I know that there's a lot of local food producers who participate in that open air market as well.
And Jennifer, anything to add?
Yeah. So I think that I forgot to mention earlier about the process of learning. is really key to this challenge. And so we're always learning, and we want to emphasize that doing this challenge is a great way to see and observe things that we want to plan for next year. So as we kind of come to the tail end of our season with foods, it's a great way to plan for next year, things we want to learn about, planning on making time for these things, or planning on finding that expert that can help mentor and teach, and those learning opportunities. And so I think the time is a huge challenge. And I think making the time for it, and planning on making the time is something that each of us can try to do. So.
Well, Jennifer and Megan, thank you so much for speaking with me today about the 7-day Eat Local Food Challenge. It sounds like it's going to be, you know, a lot of fun and exciting, and there's a lot of different ways to do it. So I really appreciate all the information that you have both shared with me today. Is there anything else that you would like to share with our listeners before we say goodbye?
Yeah, I would like to plug one kind of pre-event that's happening tonight. As we said, educational opportunities around the food system are super important to this challenge. And so Melanie Brown is actually doing a Skillshare this evening. And if folks are interested, they can find that on the Salt and Soil Marketplace website, or look us up on the Salt and Soil Facebook page or the Local Food Challenge Southeast Alaska Facebook page for the Zoom link. And she's going to be teaching a class on how to utilize bones from animals like deer and caribou and moose to make super nutritious broth. So if people are interested, that's going to be held tonight via Zoom. And that information can be found on our Facebook pages or on the website.
Great. Well, thank you both so much. I really appreciated talking with you today. And lots of luck with the food challenge on a personal level and on an organizational level. So I hope you guys have a great afternoon.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Thanks for being here. Support for Juno Afternoon comes from Heritage Coffee Roasting Company, providing Juno with locally roasted coffee for over 40 years with 7 cafes and drive-through locations throughout Juno. More at heritagecoffee.com. The past, the present, and the future of education for Alaska Native students are all interwoven, and my next guest has dedicated her career to understanding the history of how things came to be the way they are today and why they have to change. So welcome to the show, Misha Jackson Chukungi Kla. Would you please introduce yourself for our listeners?
Chukungi Kla Yuchet Tuasak Chak Nachat City Shungu Kedi Ayachet. I will leave my Tlingit introduction there and continue in English, but my name is Misha Plunkett Jackson. I am of the Eagle Moiety. I am Shungu Kedi, or from the Thunderbird clan. My house comes out of the Klukwan Haines area, and that is originally where my grandmother was from, though my mother and all of her siblings and cousins grew up predominantly in the Juneau area, but come from a long history of Juneauites and life in the canneries and traveling around Southeast. So my mom is Carmen Quinto. Hi, Mom. She asked me to say that because I'm sure she told her brothers and sisters that I was on the radio. So she wants to show off that she gets a hi, Mom. But yeah, so they come from the Quinto family. They went to Juneau Douglas High School. My older sister went to Juneau Douglas High School. I personally did not go to school in Alaska, but you know, my connections and my roots here run pretty thick, and it's kind of just always been a passion of mine to come back and work with youth in some shape or form. I currently am the assistant professor at University of Alaska Southeast in the secondary education program. God, I'm supposed to say that.
Well, don't worry. We're definitely going to talk about that.
Okay.
And you're also the speaker for this Friday's Evening at Egan Lecture. And the title of your talk is Alaska Native Education, The Power of Acknowledgement. So it's not a long title. I've definitely seen longer, but there is a lot there. I just wanted to start with you and your story, and thank you for giving me all of that information about your background and your family. But I wanted to know what motivated you to pursue education and become a professor.
Oh, wow. Education in general, I would say in some shape or form, runs through my family roots. I personally theorize and hope to eventually research in some shape or form that I truly believe Indigenous people are natural born educators. And I think it takes a lot of time in sitting with education and understanding what's around you to acknowledge that and then to utilize that. And I think it is a strength of our community that has not been tapped into quite yet. So I would say it has probably been in me, the idea of being an educator in some shape or form, probably my entire life. I think it started a lot with coaching. And I was a basketball coach in my previous life down south. And then when I met who ended up being my husband, Josh Jackson, who's a phenomenal teacher at Harborview, he helped me realize that when I was coaching and working with students, what I was doing was teaching. And I was differentiating, and I was helping all these kids be successful, no matter what their prior skills or experiences were before that. And so we did camps and stuff like that, and it kind of put the bug in my ear that I was like, oh, maybe I am made for this. And I love kids. And coaching basketball is only a small segment of time in this town, at least. And so I joined, I got a position at Juno Douglas High School, working for the Johnson O'Malley program, where I kind of like walked the fence between being a Tlingit and Haida employee and a school district employee. So I got to see kind of both angles. And I did a lot of support for our Alaska Native American Indian students, culturally diverse students, and you know, my door was always open to anybody and their friends. So a lot of tutoring, a lot of counseling, helping other teachers. And then I just started sharing ideas and things that I knew and things I'd learned since I'd been back home here in Juneau. And then I realized, I think it's time for me to be at the front of the classroom. And my oldest sister was a big one pushing me towards that. And so off I went and got my MAT and kind of just hit the ground running since I already had a lot of prior experience. And I think I always wanted to get a PhD. It was a goal of my father's and my mother's to get a PhD. And so I was like, okay, like this is it. The opportunity arose to take on this position at UAS, and I applied for it. You know, it was the middle of a pandemic. Who doesn't like a good career change in the middle of a pandemic? I have three little kids and needed a little flexibility, but I also need a little bit more accountability to myself. And I truly believe there's a lot more to do. And though I love teaching with all of my heart and I love my high school students, it kind of just felt like that moment where I needed to put my money where my mouth is, kind of a saying. And as much as I miss the classroom, I needed to step up and make a bigger difference than just being a role model in front of the classroom and being a role model inside of a university.
Yeah. Well, I think you made the right choice because your passion and your enthusiasm is just so like clear. It's palpable and infectious. So thanks so much for sharing your backstory there and how you became a professor. And now getting back to your talk and the topic at hand, when you use the phrase Alaska Native education, as you do in the title of your talk, what are you referring to? What does all that encompass?
It's a totally loaded term for me. Like anybody that's been in my class knows I love to dissect and look at words and what they mean and the concepts behind them. So majority of the words, if I do choose to use them, they're very loaded, very value-laden. And so for me, Alaska Native education is representative of all the systems that Alaska Natives are in and actively participate in. So it's Alaska Native education in terms of what that looks like in a Western education system, you know, in terms of curriculum, assessment, standards, et cetera. It's Alaska Natives students' experiences inside of education. And for me, it's also an acknowledgement of traditional Alaska Native educational systems that were in place since time immemorial, right? And are still actively in place, sometimes in schools, sometimes not in schools, sometimes in families, sometimes in ceremonies, sometimes just out in nature. Once you really get to that point of understanding it, you truly see it everywhere.
And then there's the other part of your talk's title, the power of acknowledgement. What needs to be acknowledged and how does it lend power and to whom?
Oh, man. Acknowledgement is, I think I'll start by saying acknowledgement is like an inherent value of Indigenous communities. It is not on our poster, you know, that's out there, the tribal values of Southeast Alaska. I don't know if I've seen it in other tribal values across the state, because it is in every aspect of our lives. It's almost like one of those unwritten rules that I don't think we've done enough to make transparent to those that don't experience it on a regular basis, whether they're Native or non-Native. And so acknowledging is truly the physical part where you see somebody, you acknowledge them. And then it gets bigger than that. You acknowledge where they came from. You acknowledge who they are. You acknowledge the land that you're on. You acknowledge them as human beings. You acknowledge, you know, the commonalities, the shared space we have within this big, gigantic universe, you know, and you acknowledge that there are a lot of things in this world that we can't explain. And that's okay. Right. And so for me, that's where it comes in and ties into Alaska Native education is we have to acknowledge that there's so much more to the success of Alaska Native students and the success of integrating Alaska Native pedagogy, curriculum, et cetera. There's so much more to it than what we can really put on paper. And a lot of it is feelings. And that's something people shy away from that I tried to like kind of push forward. And so we need to acknowledge like that it's okay to care. It's okay to love kids. It's okay to set high expectations. It's okay to hold yourself accountable. It's okay to be honest about the history of Alaska. It's okay to be honest about student experiences, your experiences, community experiences. Like there is just so much that we aren't being transparent about, I guess is the best way I could say. So we have to learn to acknowledge all of the physical aspects and the emotional aspects and the spiritual aspects to really create safe places for our students, our families, our communities.
When you break
how loaded was that answer?
That's awesome. I was just about to say when you break it all down like that, I can see how deliberate it was to choose the phrases and the words that you did in your title. In the title of your talk. And that's just the title.
Yeah.
So
we haven't even hit slide one yet.
So, exactly. You know. Exactly. There's so much more to unpack there. It's great.
Yeah.
So you're quoted as saying that, quote, I try to highlight how complex it has been and that we don't have single stories from history. We have stories of resilience and emphasis here. We need to quit portraying Indigenous peoples as victims where we only enter history or curriculum as victims of westward expansion or climate change. Can you say more about that?
Oh, this is my soapbox moment I have sometimes about being a teacher. And I was a social studies teacher and, you know, training new teachers and just kind of experiences and conversations. And so, a lot of it comes from frustration and personal experience. And, you know, I'm always randomly looking up data and research. And I think the National Congress of American Indians did a review, a study about Indigenous education and curriculum. And in it, it mentioned that I think something like 87% of the standards, state standards they reviewed, don't mention Indigenous communities or people after 1900. And that's profound like that. And it totally, and their report is all about like the invisibility of Indigenous people. And you know, so that's kind of where it ties into that idea of needing to be acknowledged. And so that's like my frustration is, you know, people either wait to teach about Indigenous people when it comes to westward expansion, like, oh yeah, they were on this land and, you know, now it's gone and they did X, Y, and Z and these horrible things, you know, and it doesn't bring to life everything that we have within us. It makes it very two-dimensional approach. And for people that have been living and breathing and thriving and surviving and are passionate about who they are and the land that they live on, as stewards, as caretakers, that's hard. Like that is really truly hard as someone who's heard it talked about like that, who's had students talk about it like that, you know, you swallow your pride and you kind of have to pick and choose your battles. And, you know, a lot of times it makes me wonder, is this the reason why we don't have that many Native educators? Because we have to swallow conversations like this as we move forward, you know, and we kind of have to build that shield. And so sometimes a microaggression, sometimes it's ignorance and not with malicious intent, but it does happen and it does exist and it's very common.
You've touched on this a lot, but I am curious about how much your own personal experiences, whether it was as a student yourself or as a teacher, and now as a professor and working in academia, how does that shape the way you approach your work?
Oh man, It depends on the day, to be totally honest. It can get me so fiery and feisty and frustrated. I'm using too many F's. Oh, goodness, all the English teachers are cracking up probably right now. But yeah, it can have me like that, those kinds of days. And then it can totally, you know, chop my legs out from underneath me. It takes a strong support network. And I have had numerous experiences, personal experiences, throughout my own educational experience that weren't positive, that, you know, I got being attempted to be tracked into different math levels for arbitrary reasons. And, you know, I was just like a victim of circumstance, but thankful my father stepped up and basically broke down the system. And so I've been very consciously aware of educational systems and typically the more negative role they play and have played for me. I mean, to the point where sometimes I think of all the unsatisfactory report cards I had because I wouldn't speak up in class, you know, and that actually continued into college. It was one of kind of the common marks against me is I'm quiet in class, you know, and it's just this lack of understanding, lack of appreciation of what my strengths were. And then the moments of positive, you know, and inspiration, the Indigenous teachers and professors and that I was exposed to at my undergraduate school at UC Santa Cruz, who kind of put me on this path to where I am now, giving me a job as a course reader, helping me find different job opportunities, you know, launching me into the idea of being counseling education was one of the first ideas I went into. So I've had a lot of negative experience. I've had a lot of positive experiences. I've heard a lot of stories from students. I've had to sit in my classroom and digest a lot of things that they have experienced and their perceptions. And that was probably the one thing that was the biggest charge for me was knowing student experiences here in judo and knowing the experiences from my mother and my sisters.
And now in this like moment in time, COVID-19 has thrown such a wrench in education worldwide. What are some ways that the pandemic has impacted Alaska Native education just based on your observations?
To be brutally honest, I think it's pushed us back to being invisible, I think is kind of what it feels like. You know, there are a lot of difficult conversations going on about education, and it came down to the pandemic really forces you as a teacher to decide what is essential to be taught. And then without levels of accountability in place, teachers will tend then to make a choice that incorporating, integrating Indigenous knowledge, current events, et cetera, histories, elders, et cetera, are not essential, right? They don't have the time. Is this important? We need to do X, Y, and Z that students missed before, right? And so it almost feels like it's kind of stepped us back a little bit. But for me, the argument is the same time is it's an opportunity to show people that the disruptions that have happened during COVID to all of our students are disruptions, similar disruptions that have happened to Indigenous people throughout history. And it's not a point your fingers kind of thing. It's like a stop and reflect and think about it. And then, you know, you need to make the self-assessment and the commitment to putting your best foot forward and really doing what our elders and our teachers ahead of us and our Indigenous educators have paved the way for. Like it's our job to carry that forward. To be respectful of their time, their ideas, their cultural standards, the curriculum they've developed, and we can't let it get stagnant. Mm.
Well, I so appreciate you answering all of my questions, and I just wanted to ask, we haven't really dived into the meat of your talk and what you're going to be discussing on Friday. I always have this challenge when I interview the speakers ahead of time with like wanting to hear what the talk is about, but not asking them to basically give me the whole talk. What are some of the goals that you hope to achieve with your work and with some of the things you're going to be talking about on Friday?
For me, it's really creating spaces for people to self-assess, to wonder, what they are doing and what they can do. And I always try and give ideas, never the answers, just ideas. I think that's pretty limiting to give everybody just the answers. We would definitely not be where we are today if that's how we approach these situations. So, you know, for me, it's always just about inspiring people to be accountable, to create similar spaces, you know, and hopefully it gets a few people to get really charged up and start, you know, being more vocal about it. I love giving these talks. This is my passion. Is it nerve-wracking? Absolutely. Does it make me vulnerable? Absolutely. But is it necessary? Yeah. Am I the only one? Absolutely not. There are phenomenal people out there that have said many things. And oftentimes I feel like I'm repeating the same thing. So I try and use my personal stories in my talks to kind of highlight and essentially translate some of the things that have already been said, so it can try and reach different audiences. But yeah, there are phenomenal people at UAS. I have, you know, amazing friends, teachers within Juneau School District and around Alaska, and people I've yet to meet that have done amazing work in here. And I'm just one small part of that.
Right. Well, as you mentioned, having a good social support system is really important. Well, I want to thank you again, Misha Jackson, Assistant Professor of Secondary Education at UAS, and this Friday night speaker at the Egan Lecture Series. The presentations are taking place via Zoom again this season. They're free and starts at 7 p.m. You can find out more at uas.alaska.edu/EganLecture and register there. Misha, what else would you like to share with our audience before we say goodbye today?
Oh, man. What else could I possibly share without getting in trouble?
Don't worry about that.
I know this is all. I'm all protected on the radio is the best thing. No, I think for me is reach out, support each other, challenge yourself, challenge each other, challenge our students, and you know, have some agency and create some space. And I just want everybody to just love our kids in the end.
Well, thanks so much. It's been lovely to meet you virtually, and I really appreciate the time and all the great answers to my questions. Looking forward to your talk on Friday.
Mishish, thank you for having me.
Ganashish. You're listening to Juneau Afternoon. I'm your host, Shelley Delaney. Recently, I had the opportunity to interview one of the strongest voices in public media right now, Jen White. She's currently starting her second year as host of the NPR show 1A, and you may also know her from the podcast Making, where she narrated the origin stories of Oprah Winfrey and President Barack Obama, among others. And now it's her turn to tell her story and answer the questions instead of asking them. Jen White, host of the NPR show 1A, would you like to introduce yourself for our listeners here in Southeast Alaska?
Oh, wow. I think you said most of it. I'm Jen White. I host 1A out of WAMU and NPR. I am originally a Detroiter, grew up in Michigan, the Mitten State. I've spent most of my career in the Midwest until this most recent move to D.C.
You started off your public media career in development, fundraising, moved on to an All Things Considered host, and then a podcast, Making. And now you're the host of 1A. What draws you to public radio?
I fell in love with radio as a medium when I was a little girl. My dad had a collection of tapes with old-time radio shows on them, things like The Lone Ranger. And when I was a kid, I would pop these cassette tapes into the player and just listen to them. I could listen for hours. And I fell in love with the power of the human voice and the art form of storytelling without images. That love affair with radio started when I was a kid. But then when I was about 16 years old, my older sister and I were driving somewhere. I don't remember where we were going, but she said, there's this show you've got to listen to. She was an engineer for one of the auto companies. And she said, I think you'll really like it. It's these two guys. They know everything about cars. They're really smart, but they're hilarious. And she introduced me to Car Talk. And I started my public radio listening when I was about 16 years old. Car Talk was my gateway program, and then my listening expanded from there. So it's been this sort of lifelong journey to working in public radio. So when I got a chance to work at a public radio station, Michigan Radio, in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and it was through that development door, I jumped on it because I'd been a fan and a follower for such a big part of my life.
Car Talk was your gateway program. I love that.
It was.
What are some other programs that you like now? What are some NPR shows or other shows or podcasts that you're listening to that you don't miss?
Oh, my gosh. I love Reveal. They do such a great job of investigative journalism. Of course, I tune into Morning Edition and All Things Considered, like a lot of folks who need their little jolt of news as they start their day or as they're wrapping up their commute. I love Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. I worked in Chicago for a number of years and got to know the team behind that show. And I just think it's really clever and a lot of fun. But I also love shows like Snap Judgment or The Moth Radio Hour, shows that focus on, again, that human voice and storytelling. But I got to say, I listen to a lot. I mean, public radio really shapes my day in so many ways and my weekend. During the week, I'm able to listen a bit less just because of my work schedule. But on the weekend, when I'm, you know, doing the chores, walking the dogs, all of that stuff, that's when I catch up on a lot of my public radio listening. And it just kind of really covers the gamut of what most stations air.
I can relate so hard. Well, you are the voice of 1A on NPR. You're its host. As its host, how would you describe the show?
Well, 1A is a show for people who are relentlessly curious, who want to know about things they're not going to stumble on their own. We cover politics, yes, and we try to do it through a lens that isn't just about what's happening in the Beltway. It isn't just about what's happening in D.C. Because I grew up in the Midwest, I have spent most of my career in the Midwest. I know that a lot of times the news seems to come through this filter of what's happening on the West Coast or what's happening in D.C. or on the East Coast. And there's a whole lot of country in between there. And so we definitely apply that lens to our politics coverage. But again, we talk to a lot of authors. We do a lot of arts and culture coverage. We love science discussions on this show. And fortunately, we have a great team of producers who all have different interests, different passions, and they bring all of that to the program. So the show is just so rich in content. And we also try to center the voices of people who are actually living the stories we're covering. So if we're talking about questions around oil drilling in Alaska, that is a story we've done on the show, we center the voices of people in Alaska who are going to live with the results of those decisions. I will also admit I am a science fiction and fantasy nerd. I love it all. Star Trek is like, it's been a huge part of my life. And so anytime we can get a little Star Trek in the show, I look forward to those conversations personally. But yeah, we just really think about it as this being a place where if you are interested in learning something you didn't know before, listen to 1A. The other big part of the show is listener engagement. We encourage listeners to be a part of the conversation every day by tweeting us questions or comments, leaving messages on our Facebook page, emailing us at 1A@WAMU.org. We also encourage people to leave us voicemail messages that we weave into the show, or use our Vox Pop app to leave us radio quality messages that we can also weave into the show. And then sometimes we open the phones. There are moments in the country when it feels like people need a place to just have their say. And this show is the place where they can do that.
1A premiered in January 2017, which is auspicious timing, only a few weeks after the 2016 presidential elections and shortly before, I believe, the inauguration of Donald Trump. Do you know much about how this show came to be? And has the vision changed from its premiere?
So I will say that these decisions precede my time with the show, but the Diane Rehm show, which was also a 2-hour talk show, was, I would say, a staple program of public radio. Lots of stations carried it across the country. And when Diane Rehm decided it was time to step away from the show after decades of service, there was a conversation about, okay, well, what's next? How do we create a space where people can get similar types of content, again, different because you have different hosts and different producers, but really providing a show that stations can turn to kind of try to fill that gap, but maybe also expand a little bit on what Diane's show was doing. And so the show was called 1A, of course, for the First Amendment, because this idea of listeners having a place where they can have their say, that's been part of the DNA from the very beginning of the show. So under its previous host, Joshua Johnson, who I replaced, that was just the ethos of the show from the very beginning. We want people to be a part of every conversation we have. We want listeners to drive the content. And that hasn't changed. That part of it hasn't changed. I think with every host and, you know, with changes in producer teams, you do see slight variations. Of course, there's stylistic differences that come with those changes. But that core tenet of the program, that this show is listener focused, that remains the same.
That was an excerpt from my interview with Jen White, host of 1A. You can listen to 1A on KTOO 104.3 FM Monday and Thursday mornings starting at 10 a.m. and Tuesdays and Wednesdays starting at 11 a.m. And to see our full programming schedule, go to ktoo.org.